This is Beyond the Pass, conversations with people from all walks of hospitality life. Centering mental health, Beyond the Pass is a conversation about life, hospitality, and what makes us get out of bed each day. Beyond the Pass is brought to you by Kelly's Cause, and the conversational digressions are brought to you by me, your host, Rachel Kerlapsley. If you can take a minute to like, rate, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, that would be very much appreciated. Without listeners like yourselves, we couldn't keep having these brilliant conversations. Enjoy the episode and keep taking care of each other.
Welcome back to Beyond the Pass. I'm so excited to be bringing you this conversation with Fatty Turkelman. They're a multi-hat-wearing chef and recipe developer, currently working at Willows in Clapham and running the supper club they founded, Eat Cute, designed for queer folks to eat and meet cute. With a commitment to bringing pleasure and sustainability onto the plate, they champion queer representation and environmental consciousness in the culinary world. Fatty is a passionate advocate for better mental health in the hospitality industry and in general, advocating for supportive work environments and better resources for teams. Through their platform, Food Adventures with Fatty, she shares recipes that delight us and actively fosters a more inclusive and mentally healthy culinary community. I'm so excited to have you here. Welcome.
Hi.
Thank you so much.
Nice.
Oh, stop. thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I've been very interested in what you guys have been doing since like the beginning of my career when I finally actually found you. I was like, oh, this is great. People who are doing things about mental health. So very happy to be here. Yeah. It's nice to hear all those things that you said about me. Honestly, it's like someone's written like a really positive CV. I should write all of that down for like future jobs.
I can absolutely send it to you for your website bio. Full credit to me, of course.
Yeah, yes. I'll put that at the end of every application I write.
How did you get started cooking? What was your first sort of step?
Like cooking at all or cooking for work?
Cooking at all.
I guess like my mum was pretty instrumental. She didn't really like me being in the kitchen as a child, to be perfectly honest. She was like, yes, you can just like cut that one thing and then get out of here. But she was always really experimental. And she was an air steward back in the day of like glamorous air stewarding before it was like a lot harder. And so she traveled a lot. And like whenever she would come back home, she would bring back like ideas of different things to eat. So as like a 6-year-old, I knew about like sofrito, which like, you know, I don't know if other 6-year-olds knew about that or cared. But like, and her food was always so tasty. And people would come round to our home if they knew she was cooking. So they were like, oh, is your mum making blah, blah, blah food? And they would all like pile in and then she would like bask in all of the acclaim. And I was like, this looks great. I can make food for people and then they'll give me compliments. That sounds great. but also it was just really nice to see. She never knew what she was going to cook. She would just be like, just see what was in the fridge and go, okay. And as a kid, you always wanted to know. I wanted to be prepared. And then, you know, she would start off going, oh, I'm going to be making some chicken. And by the end of it, I was like, this is not chicken. You've made something completely different because you changed your mind halfway through. But it was always super tasty. And I was such a particular fussy kid with food that, yeah, she made quite significant efforts to do that. And then to make food nice for me. And then I guess as I got older, like my parents split up, I moved from Nigeria to the UK. I started experiencing mental health problems when I was quite young, when I was like 12, 13. And now when I look back at my chef career, I suppose, it's the people who provided food for me, like as care, have really stuck out. And those meals have really stayed with me. And even eating, you know, those things now just brings me a sense of like warmth from those, you know, people helping me through difficult times. So yeah, bit of that.
What is the best and worst job that you've ever had in a kitchen?
Saying the worst job you've had is a tricky one, isn't it? Because you don't want to like call people out too much. I guess the first couple I had were quite challenging because I didn't really understand the industry. Like I came from the NHS where everyone was, you know, it was a really difficult job and everyone understood that people were under pressure all the time. There was such a high rate of burnout. You know, I was one of the people that burned out of the NHS. And so people were just kind to each other all the time, more or less. More or less, they were like really nice, very polite, very thoughtful, you know, because we were all under so much stress. So when I got to hospitality and went into like casual fine dining as my second job and was like, what? people shouting? I don't understand why people are shouting at each other. We're just making lunch, which obviously now being there for longer, I understand a bit better the stresses of the industry and why people get to that. Never worth shouting at people. I just don't, I don't understand it. But like, there was this place I worked at, a casual fine dining place that used to be based in Clapham that is now closed, which was like, I was definitely one of the older people in the kitchen. So I was surrounded by like 20-year-olds who were kind of climbing over each other a little bit to be noticed. It was quite a bitchy environment. People were always sort of slagging each other off. And there were like, having a break was just considered like a dirty word. And you'd get there at like 8 a.m. and sometimes you'd finish at like 1 o'clock in the morning. And I'm like, in the middle of the day, I was like, yeah, I need to go sit down for 20 minutes. And people were like, what do you mean sit down? And I was like, because my legs are going to fall off. What do you mean? What the hell do you mean? So like, it was difficult. There were too many gay jokes, too many Irish jokes, too many, like just all these awful jokes. And whenever I would, you know, and I'm not, I don't tolerate that thing very well, those sorts of things very well. So I would be like, yeah, I'm not comfortable with that George Michael joke you made. That's not okay. I am a queer person. You're going to make it uncomfortable for other queer people to be out in this environment. And what would happen is people would just talk about it until I entered the room and then the room would go quiet. And that was, yeah, it was awful. It was awful. But like, I mean, I'm relatively thick skinned with these things, but even I found that such a challenge. And the, so that was just bad environment, I think, in the kitchen. It was actually a really, the food was really fantastic. And they were very good with like sustainability and waste and stuff. But the environment was trash. Like, and it really gave me an insight into how it could be. And I think they thought they were doing it better, which was a real shocker to me. I was like, if this is better, what else is out there? And there was another place, actually. Oh my God, actually, there's a few baddies in there. But there was another place I worked at that was like this ultra sustainable place. And the guy that ran it cared about everything to do with the environment, but like, and pretended to care about people, but didn't really give a shit about people. And we found this out because he hired us on the day that I arrived. It was like, surprise, this isn't going to be a restaurant, it's going to be a deli. So I've been hired for a job that was a different job when I arrived. I was like, all right, we'll adjust. First paycheck was 3 weeks late, but we were like, you know, he's building something, we'll give him a bit of leeway. And then he basically like hired us to run and plan an event to gather money to pay staff that he had fired before that he didn't have money to pay, but he knew, he hired us knowing he didn't have the money to pay us. And as soon as the event was over, he fired us, like all of us at the same time. And then I had to take him to tribunal. I had to chase him down for like, I think it was like £2,500 for months. It was right in the middle of the cost of living crisis. So yeah, he was a bit of a bell end. and it was so bad for like self-esteem, you know, because it was a difficult time for chefs in general because there weren't that many restaurants and stuff open. I was only a few, two, 3 years into a new career. And so it was very challenging. And you were like, well, what am I supposed to do now? And who do I trust in this industry? If these people who say they're doing these nice things are actually exploiting.
Full of shit.
Yeah, basically. Just like the most basic form of exploitation.
Yeah. It's not even hiding. And there's something about that. One of the biggest detriments to mental health in this industry is not being valued just like as a person. And there's lots about the job that can make you feel that way, you know, like demanding guests, for example, like treating you lower. Like there's all sorts of things that we can't really control. But when an operator within the industry is promoting workplace practice or like not at all promoting workplace practice, like literally not paying their teams or hiring people in bad faith, like that just boils my piss.
Yeah, it was it was pretty horrific. I actually, oh my gosh, it like literally brought out like the pure rage in me, like because I was so upset about it all. And he like lived next door to the restaurant and was ignoring all of our phone calls and pretending that he didn't have a phone and ignoring all our emails. And so I was like, I know where you live. So I just went around there and knocked on the door and was like, what the hell is going on? It's been weeks. You have to respond. And he answered the door and was like, why are you banging on my front door? And I was like, you don't answer your phone or any of your stuff. I don't know how else I'm meant to get in contact with you. And he said, well, I don't have a phone. But he had a phone in his hand. He had a phone in his hand when he was talking to me. But anyway, yeah, he was one of the absolute worst. But like, there have been some really great places though as well, to be honest with you. Like where I'm working, the best few, maybe, I think I'll go with, like, the when I was working at the Camberwell Arms, I had a bit of a tricky situation with one of the chefs there, but I think they just had bad training around like how to manage people. I think they'd become more senior, but hadn't really learned what it was, what managing people was about. So they were very punitive. But on the whole, it was a really caring environment. They made a really good point of trying to make sure that people, you know, we wouldn't necessarily leave on time, but whoever does in hospitality, but they just kind of cared a little bit more. I worked for a while at Caribe in Brixton when that was there. That was definitely one of my best jobs. I'm actually now really good friends with the owner because they were a one-man band doing everything on their own. They cooked, they cleaned, they did everything. There was just one of them. So I found them through an article that they'd written about like migration and food. And I was like, this person sounds like they're interested in things that I am. So I visited them like a stalker. I got on my bike and I stalked them out. And I went over to the restaurant and was like, I read your article and you just seem really cool. And I feel like we should be allies. And they were a bit spun out and were like, this is fucking weird. And then later they contacted me and were like, and offered me a job. So I worked there. They had outdoor seating because it was over COVID. So I worked with them. This is the lovely Keisha. And they just did it. They just did it very differently. They're exceptionally kind and thoughtful, very calm, cool and collected. Like we're kind of like fire and ice in terms of day-to-day mannerisms. I'm like 100 miles an hour and really super hyper. And they were just like really laid back and chill. So we made a really good team and they really cared about what they were doing. And, you know, we're representing food from across the Caribbean and they wanted the story behind those foods, even if it was a bit of a murky history, to be told. So I just really respected what they did and working with them was a breeze. When I eventually left, we both did quite a lot of crying. It was quite sweet. Like, I mean, I know I definitely did a lot. Like potentially it was more me, but like, you know, that was nice. And where I work now is really nice. Like Willows in Clapham, you know, they tried to make it's a queer and women forward restaurant. So I think like something like 80% of us that work there are like queer people. And it has made a difference. There's a lot less misogyny in the kitchen. There's a lot less misogyny. They're very mindful around, like it's quite rare that you'll do doubles because as we know, those sorts of hours actually erode people's mental health and add to anxiety and stuff like that. You know, that's very rare that that happens there. It's only if they're very, very stuck. And, you know, they really do try and, you know, no one gets it right all of the time, but they really do try and make staff feel very valued, which is great. And I also worked at the Common Press in Bethnal Green, which is like, it's now a queer bookshop and event space. But at the time they had a bar and we were meant to be opening a restaurant there. And there working within the queer space was just great. I'd never done that before. You know, as a younger person, you know, my access to queer community was actually quite limited. It was limited through like gay bars that are set up by cis white gay men. And as a result, those environments are really to serve that community more so. I don't think it's intentional, but that's kind of what's interesting. So the Common Press was quite different. It's people of colour forward and marginalised gender forward. That was kind of their, like, you know, what's the word I'm looking for, like framework or whatever. It was great. It was like, it was not to sound too cheesy, but it was a bit like coming home. I was like, oh, yes, this is where I want to be. I want to be working within this kind of space and I really want to be serving my community. And again, people made a really big effort being like kind to each other. I work with the best, like the person that I was working with in the restaurant, there were two people I was working with. They're just the best. They were so like, just really forward thinking, really considerate, you know, and we just really appreciated each other, to be honest. And we treated each other with respect, with respect, you know, it's so mad that I have to out. It's like, yeah, it's such a fucking basic part of things. But the truth is a lot of places don't treat people with respect. Mm. So I really value it when people do. But in the end, we couldn't open that restaurant. It like Liz Truss came and fucked shit for everyone. So like we couldn't open the restaurant because it wasn't financially viable for the owner anymore. It really like made an imprint on me about how I then wanted to go forward with my work after that, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we get really trapped by certain metrics of success where it's like, so by any metric, like not actually opening the restaurant you were trying to is like not a metric of success. But no, I think that's such a But it's a busted framework because you have that experience and it sets out an alternative map and an alternative infrastructure and it informs the way that you want to move. And that is just as much a success as anything else.
Yeah, definitely. Like it was a real shame that it didn't open. We were all super devastated because what we wanted to create, you know, we had like aspirations of creating a kind of dating space for queer people and making it affordable and all this kind of stuff. We've all stayed in contact and I'm actually working with one of them again now with my own project, so that's quite nice. But like, yeah, I think even like really shitty jobs teach you something, don't they, about how to kind of like progress from there, or at the very least, what the fuck not to do.
I think I probably learned more from the worst environments I was in than from the best ones. And largely a reminder of how detrimental it is. Because I think that when you're in environments that are like medium bad and sort of like, I would say like even industry good, where like it's horrible, but it's sort of like bog standard. It's so easy to not pay attention to the impact it can have on your mental health. Mm-hmm. And then when you're in like an extremely bad environment, you're like, oh, right, this is a horrible way to live and it's not sustainable and I'm going to burn myself out.
Yeah, and I think because I'm someone who's like experienced burnout before, I'm quite sensitive actually to those sorts of like dynamics in like at workplaces. And because my old job was occupational therapy, like part of what I did was risk assess for people's like mental health and physical health. Like, and so when I'm in a restaurant kitchen, I can't help but see the glaring red flags. They just really stand out to me, and they're impossible to ignore because otherwise you're just complicit, aren't you, in the problem.
How did you start out doing recipe development?
Over COVID, actually. So when COVID hit, I'd been a chef for like a year and a half. And at the time, you know, when I first joined, it was quite easy to find a job as a chef, actually. There were like a bajillion restaurants in London. And if you didn't like one, you just move on to another one. It was not like the end of the world. There were always options. And then COVID hit and then everything shut. And I was like, what have I done? Oh my God, this is a disaster. What am I going to do when a restaurant's going to open again? This is fucking terrible. And I just panicked. And I'm like, I'm such a hyperactive person and such an extrovert. I didn't cope very well with lockdowns. So I started my Instagram page during that time. And it's because I just realized, like, if I'm going to get a job at the end of this, people need to know I exist at all. And so decided to like start an Instagram page. And then like, I know, and I was trying, you know, I financial insecurity is not a comfortable place, I think, for anyone. And I, you know, was looking around for opportunities to work as a chef. How can I still do this? And I realized that veg box delivery companies were springing up all over the place because nobody wanted to go to the supermarket and be breathed on by people. like, I remember nearly knocking this poor, like, this woman over because I was in the supermarket and she leant over me to get something. And I went, ah! And like jumped back, nearly knocked her over and was like, sorry, sorry, but you're breathing so close to me. Like, no one wanted anyone breathing on them. So anyway, I started contacting all these like new veg box delivery companies because I figured they're new, I'm new, they might be. I don't need to get paid very much at that time or whatever in order to do it. And so I would offer to like write recipes and make like a video for them and they would offer me money and then I would have to quickly go and learn how to make a video because I didn't know how to do that, but you know, blagged it and made a couple of videos and they were fine and they seemed happy with them. And then got like contacted by some people at Hackney Council, contacted me as part of a thing that they were doing to look at Black people who were working with the environment in one way or another. And I did like pickling workshops for them. And then I went and worked for a little while. So I had to like develop all the recipes for all of these things. I went and worked for a billionaire for a short time as a private chef in their flat, like making them dinner three times a week.
How was that?
Interesting. Like for 10 months, it was because we made an agreement that I was part of their bubble. They lived very close by. I just drove from me to them directly, if you know what I mean, did not pass go. And like, if they got COVID, everyone in my house got COVID. So we all had, I had to ask everyone whether that was all fine ultimately, you know. And so like not during the time, so you know, we weren't like
of course, yeah,
but But they were very like open for me to cook whatever I wanted and gave me a relatively big budget to buy ingredients. So stuff that I wouldn't normally be able to afford to trial at home, I could trial. I was like,
that is so cool. What an amazing opportunity. Like,
it was. It was a really good opportunity. And they were really kind about everything that I made. And they were happy for me to like be quite experimental with some things. Some things did not go to plan. And I had to do a lot of apologizing and was like, don't worry, you don't have to pay for this one. And they were always like, no, it's fine, we'll pay you. Like, it was fine until it wasn't fine. I think when you're a private chef, you have to be getting on really well with the person whose house you're in, because it's their home. And when I think there was a little bit of, they took a little bit of advantage at the end there, where they were like, we had a cancellation policy and they were like, oh, we're not gonna we suddenly want to go abroad tomorrow. And I was like, well, I've bought the ingredients and I've already started prepping, so you'll need to pay for those. And then I was kind of guilt tripped with, but we offered you our house in Saint-Tropez to go and hang out in sometime. So why do we have to pay for these things? And I was like, okay, you're not living in the world of the rest of us who have to worry about bills and mortgages and whatnot.
You can't use the house in Saint-Tropez to pay for your internet?
Well, to be honest, I think I didn't want to cross those boundaries anyway. No. On the one hand, I was like, oh, yes, lovely villa in Saint-Tropez that I can go and have a holiday in. And I just thought, no, this feels like it's going to cross a boundary. I'm just going
to. And very hard to do that. And especially like thinking about maybe your younger self, or like before you'd been through burnout with the NHS and into a new career and figuring all this out and drawing all these boundaries, like a less practiced version of yourself would have been like, okay, you know,
I'd have been like, that sounds great. I'm bringing like a boyfriend or a girlfriend. I'm going to bring someone, or a they friend. I'm going to bring someone with me and have a really fun time in this random place. But yeah, I just thought, this is going to get held against me at some point. And it was. And then I also had like a mentorship through Be Inclusive Hospitality, who are like, those people who aren't aware, they're like the UK's leading hospitality organization for accelerating racial equity. And they were doing a mentorship scheme. And I was like, well, that's what I need. Like, hospitality doesn't have very clear signposts as to how to progress your career. Whereas in the NHS, it was like, if you want to do this, if you want to get to this point.
Yes, do X, Y, and Z. Yeah.
Yeah, it was extremely clear. But I just found it was like a bit like, it was just like the Wild West in hospitality. I don't know what the hell I was meant to be doing. So I got this mentorship and I was very lucky to be matched up with Easter Belfridge, who's like ex-Ottolenghi, and now is like a very well-known chef and has like, you know, has a couple of cookbooks now, I think, maybe one or two, or they're working on a second, something like that. They had quite an unconventional route into chefing as well. Like, they weren't trained classically, or whatever people say. I don't want to say classically, but you know, they didn't go to school for it. Like, neither did I. And they also work quite cross-culturally with the way that they design recipes, as do I. And so, yeah, I basically asked them to teach me how to develop recipes, and it was such a valuable experience. Like, I think I was their first person that they'd mentored. So they were always a bit nervous that were they being a good enough mentor. And I was like, you have no idea how like valuable this is. It's so valuable. And so it really helps. So there are a number of things really, but I just couldn't sit around during COVID. I just had to be doing something. So I needed to find, and I also realized during that time that, you know, I joined kitchens a bit later than most people would. I'm like 42. I joined when I was like in my late 30s. And I realized quite quickly that there's going to be limited time that I'm going to be able to stand on my feet.
Physically do it. Yeah.
Yeah. My knees were hurting. I've got plantar fasciitis now. Like, I get a click in my thumb if I've been working for too long, and in my shoulder, it's a bit sore and whatever. And I was like, oh, I'm going to need to like accelerate into recipe development quite quickly, because my body actually won't hold out for like another 10 years of doing this. I'm going to start to actually injure myself in one way, especially coming from healthcare. I can see the risks. So I was like, oh, nah, I need to find a way to hurry up and get good at recipe development. So I just did all kinds of weird things. Oh, I went on like a couple of courses with Leeds, like through Be Inclusive as well, like did a food styling course. And then I just bought books and then just like really poured all the way through them. I'd go to my butcher and be like, can I get a leg of lamb? Because I'd be, say if I'm like learning how to like section up meat or something, or to debone things or whatever, And they would give me, like, you know, a standard leg of lamb that you put in your oven. And I was like, oh, no, sorry. I actually mean from the hip to the toe. And then I would carry the entire leg through Clapham High Street back to my house. People must have been like, all right, okay, good to know that no one's sanity is being kept together during COVID. But just there with this massive leg of lamb and then just roll up at home with it and then work out how to, like, carve it out, probably on the billionaire's money. So if they are ever hearing this, thanks for that, guys. But, like, yeah, cutting that all up at home to practice, you know. And so, yeah, I just upskilled at home.
I mean, those were crazy times. Like, I'm not even sure I would have noticed. Another day, another lamb leg, you know.
I like seeing what people were like in the park. People in parks were just wild. We were all quite unhinged. People just within, I think it took about 2 weeks for people to be just in pajamas in the park, like, all the time. Watching people exercise their children was my favorite. It was so weird.
Literally running them around like it was a dog show.
There was one woman who used to get her kid to run around a tree and she would just stand there and count 47, 48. This five-year-old was like, just running around a single tree. And I was just
You gotta respect it.
I was like, those parents are at their wit's end. They've got to do what they've got to do.
What is the tastiest thing that you've made so far this year?
Oh, God. That's a hard one. Because I get bored quite easily. So I'll eat something and be like, that's yummy. And then I'll eat it three times and I'm like, bored now. I need to eat something else. So that's quite a hard one for me to answer.
You can just say a tasty thing you've made this year, if that's helpful.
A tasty thing. Okay. I'll give you like top three. Maybe that's easier. Because I don't actually know. One, like a sweet corn and lime leaf pakora with like a fermented green hot sauce. That was like quite good. Like smoked chicken with like fermented blackberry barbecue sauce. That was pretty good. And it had like crispy spiced hazelnuts and shallots on the top. And I'm currently working on like a something I've been just obsessing about for weeks. And it's going to be kind of like a sweet potato pie, but like Oreo base and then purple sweet potato, but flavored with ube. And then like burnt honey, like chantilly-esque kind of cream, and then like ube marshmallows on the top. That's what I'm like obsessing about at the moment.
Honestly, thank God this isn't film, because it's just me drooling on my own top.
Like, those are things that I've enjoyed and I'm obsessing about. But yeah, I get bored real easy, so I then just start making different stuff.
Can you speak a little bit to the ways that your personal experience has shaped your creativity and the way that you work in kitchens now?
I think what I was talking about a little bit before in terms of like people making meals for me when I was having difficult times and relating it to kind of like care has really made like an impact on the way that on what I choose to make. Actually, often I'll often be in, like, if someone asks me to write a recipe for something, I'm 9 times out of 10 I'm inspired by something somebody else has made for me. So I recently made like a recipe for a well-known supermarket that involved deep fried pickles, which was reminded me of going to see my sisters in America. And because I initially was like, ah, deep fried pickles, that sounds horrific. They are.
It's the best.
What was I even thinking?
So good.
They're like the absolute best. And like, and then also, I suppose, like, you know, I try to be as sustainable as I can, which I'm not going to lie, is harder with a smaller budget and with current like cost of living crisis stuff and stuff being so much more expensive. It's harder to be a bit more sustainable. But I do a lot of like pickling and fermenting just to not waste. And it was born out of necessity. Like, you know, like I was saying, COVID times were financially tricky for everyone. And I just didn't want to throw anything away. And so I just started to become more and more creative about how can I preserve this? There was a point I was like, I knew a chef that used to make, my friend Ollie, he used to make powdered tomato vines and use it to dust the rims of like Bloody Marys and stuff like that. And I was like, what else can I do with tomato vines? So at one point I had like so many tomato vines in my freezer, and then I used them to make like an oil. And actually that oil is really brings out the flavor of soft herbs, like massively. And if you use it to make like a pesto or something like that, it's immediately a lot more herby. I don't know how to describe it. Like, yeah, a lot more herby. So that was quite
nice. That's so cool.
Yeah, there were a lot of things that went like not so well. Like I was taught by this artist, Innes. I can't remember her surname now, but anyway, Innes does a lot of stuff with like art and fermentation. And she like uses sourdough starter. If you put it into like a sweetened like drink, it makes it carbonated. It carbonates it for you. But if you forget to like put it in the fridge after 3 days, it literally explodes in your house. So just word to the wise, like, just be cautious. Like, we were sitting watching TV, me and my then husband, and we were like, I suddenly heard this wild high-pitched noise, and it was basically one of the bottles screaming, and we had to like put two towels over it to open it, and it just fucking exploded everywhere. Like, it was absolutely unreal. So yeah, there were a few things that went badly, but yes, just trying to be a bit sustainable and waste less has definitely also been a bit of like a influence, I suppose.
You spoke a little bit about the kitchen environments, particularly as a queer person, and as particularly as a queer person who's not really that interested in eating shit. And I wonder what changes you can identify as being necessary in the industry to create environments where all chefs, especially queer and gender nonconforming folks, can feel safe and welcomed.
Oh, God, I think the thing is, it's quite a big hill at the moment, if I'm honest. Like, I think that, like, training, not to sound too basic, but training, people going on, like, ED&I training and actually, you know, implementing the training. It's all well and good going on training and learning all of the things and theoretically feeling like you will use those things at work. But if you don't have an actual plan of how you're going to implement those changes in your workplace, it's actually quite hard to translate it from training to real work.
So completely.
Get your staff on some ED&I training stat, especially managers, and have a real plan on how you're going to implement that changing. And I don't know, review it like once a year. Like, it's not even, I think that even that will make quite a big difference. But when it comes to gender, I think we still use quite gendered language with diners, you know, a lot of sir and madaming all over the place.
With front of house teams, especially, you know, give the man your plate, give the lady your plate, like tell the lady you need a water. Like, yes. It's so gendered.
Hello, sir, would you like to take a seat or whatever? Mm-hmm. And it's, I just think that we can get past that now. And there are ways of being polite. You don't have to refer to someone in that way. You can just speak very politely and talk around gender. You know, I don't know. Maybe, I think it's a language thing for some people. It just takes a little bit of time to get used to. But ultimately, I think that would make quite a big difference. And for those people who are frequently misgendered, you know, well, they'll notice. They will notice that that restaurant has made an effort to do that. And it will definitely make a difference for the staff as well. You know, you go, oh, okay, this is a place that actually cares about that. Like, that actually cares about that. So those would be my two top tips for the now, I think.
Yeah, I think you bring up something really interesting in terms of training and that difficulty to translate what you're learning in that environment to your actual work. And I would love to see an ED&I training that's facilitated by a chef, because the reality of taking, like, I just did one and it was great and it felt very applicable and I learned a lot. I'm also like in a fair, I mean, not a corporate environment, but like, we're a small team. We work 9 to 5. We're Monday to Thursday. We have a lot of control over how we engage with people. And if somebody's a dickhead, I'm like, okay, we're not, no thanks. Like, I'm the boss and I say no. Like, you know, there's a certain measure of control. And so for me, I walked away from that and I was like, great, super. But I was like, if realistically I could take this training, but if I'm walking into a kitchen where there's 50 people, they're from all different countries, all different experiences, all different vocabularies. We're going to serve 300 people tonight and we're short staffed. At what point can I really put this into practice? If I do hear somebody say something, or if something does go wrong, or if somebody mentions something to me, and remembering, I think it's really important that folks that are making decisions around policy are close, or at least very closely connected to the lived experience of the people that they're making policy for.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I find so often with that kind of training and facilitation, and it happens in the mental health space too, I think it's across the board, where it's like, okay, but this isn't going to work for the people that need it the most, because when are they going to think about this? You know, like, thinking about advice you sometimes get around panic attacks and how to stave off a panic attack. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, no, the advice you need is to like go stand in a walk-in fridge and put a steak on your chest for real.
Yeah,
you know, that's the advice you need. And so I think that I see a little bit of a gap in ED&I training where I've never seen a facilitator who was coming at it from that lived experience of like, this isn't going to be perfect and we are not going to get it right, but here's ways that you can adapt it.
Maybe I should start doing some. Maybe I should start facilitating some training.
I mean, for real, I think that's also why when you're now working in an environment where you're a little bit further along in your career and you have a little more power in those spaces, you're having a better and better and better experience the further you go because you're setting the tone.
Yeah. And I mean, I think I've made a conscious point to be quite, to be very out with my queerness in my chef life. And some people find it quite unusual. I had a family member say to me, but the food isn't going to taste different because you're queer. People just were a bit like, didn't really see the point. But the point is because there are these barriers as a result of a queer person that do impact your experience in like the hospitality space. Mm. And so for those of us who are, because it's not possible for everyone to be like that, to be as out at work. Maybe their workplace doesn't support that, or actually it's not something that they're able to manage emotionally. It might just be very, very difficult for all kinds of reasons. But for those of us who do feel empowered to talk more openly about our queerness, you know, in those spaces, I would encourage that because it just normalizes talking about it. And it also then normalizes for those people that might, you know, might be about to slip into a little gay joke or whatever there, that like, actually, that's not acceptable in this. It's not acceptable. you're going to alienate staff members by doing that. So yeah, for those people who are, you know, able to be empowered to be their full queer self at work, I would just encourage it. I guess that's why I've like ended up doing a fair bit of activism is, like I said, I can't unsee these things. And it feels like the best way to like be in the system is to try and actively change those things, even in just small ways where I can.
Can you talk about how you came up with Eat Cute Supper Club and what the experience of running it has been like?
So EQ, I think the initial kind of like idea was born when I was working at the Common Press when we were going to be opening a restaurant there, because I just loved the idea of being part of people's love story. And like, you know, like queer dating can be like, you have to pick your venues carefully about where you're going out to and stuff like that so that you don't have a horrible time. You know, I just really wanted to facilitate that, but it never happened. And so I was approached by Aisha of Moonlight Experiences, who are a company that run they basically like facilitate queer events, and they're often people of color led queer events. And they asked if I wanted to do a supper club. And so I was like, can I please make it a dating supper club? I was also like starting to get divorced at the time. Like, for, you know, everyone knows divorce is really shit and hard, even mine, that was actually quite amicable, was just a massive life change after like over a decade of being with this person, and it just sucked the life out of me a little bit. And the idea of being, and I'm polyamorous, so even during my marriage I was like seeing various people, so you know, I think it's maybe a different experience to the like monogamous sort of life where you're like, it's my one person and that one person's gone and now I'm alone, you know, that people can sometimes go or whatever. Like, there's a Cat Burns song about it called Alone that if you don't know, you should definitely check out. It's really good. It's very funny. But and so I wasn't like alone in that, you know, in the way that people perceive. Not that I don't really believe in all that shit anyway, but you know, but I did feel like such a sense of loss. I just felt like facilitating a place where other people can like have connection, or like a bit of a safer space for connection, would be quite healing for my divorce. But also, like, there aren't many places to kind of like do this kind of dating, basically. Like, I'm not really someone who wants to go raving all the time. I can't be arsed. I kind of need to go.
You're tired.
I am too fucking tired for that shit. Like, you know, and you know, when you go to those spaces, they tend to be also quite like, we are for this kind of person or this kind of person from within the rainbow, you know, like breaking down the demographics, which is necessary because often, you know, like I was saying, most of the spaces are quite homogenous. And so I can see why these different spaces have popped up. But I wanted to, you know, I'm like a pansexual person, I'm a polyamorous person. I date quite broadly in terms of types of people. And I wanted to facilitate a space that was available for that, where it was pan queer for a start, which makes it quite laid back anyway, because it means that you're going to go, there may not be people there who are the people that you fancy, or even the like gender or sexual orientation that you're interested in, but you're going to know that everyone in the room is like single or available for connection if they're polyamorous, because we also target polyamorous, polyamorous communities, because it just seems to be quite quiet, but as queer people, there's quite a lot of us polyamorous actually. And so I just wanted to facilitate a safer space, and one that just thought about our needs a bit more. And my space is like people of color and marginalized gender forward intentionally, but it is for everyone. It is for everyone to be able to come to, but I wanted to make sure that those of us who didn't really feel like our needs are generally being met within the queer space could feel seen somewhat within that space. And it's fun. It's super fun. Like, it's really fun to do. I love cooking for people. It feels a bit like everyone's coming over to my house. And I'm kind of blind dating everyone, if you know what I mean. Like, not me dating them, but you know, I mean, you never know. But like,
a little, yeah. I see what you're doing here. Like,
there definitely have been like ex and current lovers that have come to the events. So yeah. But like, it just feels really wholesome and nice. And there weren't really spaces like it, I suppose. And I think one of the things that we're sort of doing with the space is trying to bring together queer like organizations as well. So with every event that we run, there is a charity that we've like picked that you can donate to that's a queer charity, and we talk about them and uplift them. We also try and like partner with like queer brands. So for example, the last two we've been doing cocktails with Cremante Rum, which is, they're amazing. They're like a POC and queer run rum company. They make really delicious like tamarind and plantain rums. And if there are local businesses that are queer owned, we also spotlight them as well. So, you know, we're not getting like sponsorship for it, at least at this stage. But we just felt it was important. We're like, well, while we're here and while we're bringing queer people together, let's also uplift queer businesses and use queer brands in our like implementation of the supper club. But I've just really loved it. It's been so gratifying. People have been hooking up, which is great. It's exactly what I hoped for. People have been messaging me being like, ooh, I slid into somebody's DMs. I know that there are definitely a couple of people who ended up dating for a while there. Like, whether they still are, I don't know. But like, you know, it's just been, and I've been watching people flirt. Like, you know, like it's been, I saw like a cheeky little bum squeeze at one of them and was like, this is perfect. This is exactly what I wanted to happen. So now it's just getting the word out there so more people know about it. And we're hoping to do some quite interesting collabs in the new year, which I won't say too much about. Keep it a bit of a secret.
This idea that you could sit down, like, okay, you can go to a club or a rave or whatever, and you can see a lot of hot people. And that's fun. You know, you're like, there's a lot of hot people here, and that's delightful, and we're going to whatever.
You don't know if they're all available, but you do know at my event that everybody is up for connection.
And, like, that you're actually going to talk to people.
Yeah.
Because there is so often where I end up chatting to someone at a party or at a supper club or whatever, or like, I don't know, at a work thing, where all of a sudden I'm like, oh, I vibe with you so much. And it's like, because you've chatted, because you've made that connection, that just from, like, seeing a hot person across the room, I mean, maybe you had a different experience than I. But like, I was never like, oh yeah, and thus my cup is full. My cup runneth over with all these beautiful people. And there's something about creating an environment where like, and I think especially over food, it facilitates a kind of conversation that like, there's a reason why you can be at a work thing, and then the minute you sit down and have to have a meal, all of a sudden the tone of the conversation changes. People talk more about their personal lives. They're more just having a regular conversation over a meal because we all know what to do. In a way, when you're standing there with like an hors d'oeuvre and a cup of wine and like pushed into the corner in the basement of some hotel, you just don't.
Well, I guess also like people have come together who are interested in food, and so there's already like a little bit of a talking point, you know, to kind of begin with. But we do try and do things to sort of softly facilitate conversation. So I think initially we were doing a thing where underneath your plate, when your main course was taken away, there were like quirky little icebreaker kind of questions and things. And for our Pride special, we got people, we had the movers and the shakers. So the shakers were people who didn't necessarily, who stayed still, or for whatever reason couldn't move, like, you know, they might have had reasons why they didn't want to or couldn't. And then the mover have I got this right around? Yeah, shakers were sitting down. And then the movers, once a course, would move a table along. So each course, you'd be talking to a different person, which I think worked really well for some people. And some people found it a little exhausting. So yeah. It depended. And then this time round, we had like beer pong, but not actual beer pong, because not everyone is drinking and it is a Monday night. But it was like beer pong. But if you got it in, then there was a question in there and the person had to answer a question, like some kind of fun little sexy question. And all of these things sort of facilitate a conversation. And then the playlist, I put the playlist together myself and it's basically like my makeout playlist. It's like just all slutty music. But also predominantly people of color artists and queer artists on there, so that it's like representing in that way as well. But while people are listening to it, there was a point where I was doing like a little intro speech at the beginning of one of the events and Genuine's Pony just came on, like, if you're home, get to it. And I could just see people giggling in the corner and I was like, yes, this is perfect. But yeah, it's been great. And I think also it's been a really good like opportunity to find a better way of, you know, try to explore better ways of working within the kitchen and working with, you know, all the people that work with me. We're a very diverse team in terms of like gender and heritage, and also experience, actually. We all have quite different experiences, which is really enriching. And, you know, I'm trying to, you know, like, I think, yeah, I'm trying to get everyone like mental health trained through you guys, like, ideally within 6 months, but you know, everyone has different like seeing what we can do, because I think it's really important, especially within the sort of space that we're facilitating. You know, we're facilitating a space for connection where people are going to be coming often on their own or feeling a bit nervous,
a little vulnerable.
Yeah, like I'm neurodivergent, so I'm like, you know, I'm just aware about trying to make the space like as neurodivergent friendly as possible. We're trying to like find a space that's a bit more like physically accessible, as we haven't been very that at the moment, but
it's so hard in London.
Yeah, it's really tricky, and I think because we're quite small, having the money to put down a deposit is a bit tricky, so we're like you know, looking for grant funding and stuff like that at the moment, and yeah, probably sponsorship in the future, we'll see. But yeah, just kind of trying to run the event in a way that is better for everybody involved and that they have a positive working experience that does actually consider their needs, you know?
Well, and it's such a nice opportunity because you've spent time in other people's kitchens where like you could just see so blatantly that needs weren't being met, and so to have a little incubator where you can be like, okay, well, instinctually I feel like this could be done in a different way, and now I can prove that it can be done in a different way.
Yes, exactly. And like, you know, like I said, like no one's perfect with these things. I'm sure I'm making my own mistakes along the way, but that is definitely the aim, and I try to keep it as an open forum as possible for people to be able to feedback what is and isn't working for them, who, you know, people that work for EQT.
Can you very quickly let people know where they can find out more about EQT, buy tickets for EQT, and where they can find you online and follow along?
Yes, you can find me on Instagram. I'm under Food Ventures with Fatty. So it's foodventures_with_Fatty, F-A-T-T-I. And that's where we talk about EQ, and also that's where you can find out when the next event is coming up. And the tickets are sold through Moonlight Experiences, which people should check out anyway. Like, they just do some really interesting queer events all over London and actually all over the world. I think they do Paris, New York, a few other places. And that's where you can buy the tickets. And then we also often put tickets on OutSavvy as well.
Okay, perfect. And we'll link all of that in the description to this episode below, so everyone can just head there or head to our Instagram and you'll be able to find your way there super easily. And before I let you go, I just want to ask a few quick fire questions.
Oh, okay. Oh God, I worry that my ADHD impulsivity is going to get me in the shit.
Honestly, whenever I do this with anyone who's ADHD, they're like, do you hate me? Are we enemies now? And I'm like, don't worry about it.
Okay, let's try it.
What is your go-to meal when you need a little comfort?
It is either quite a spicy, like chicken curry, Punjabi style chicken curry, because it's one that I kind of grew up with, or ice cream, just basic bitch ice cream. Yeah.
Who is your celebrity crush?
Oh my God, I actually can't think of anyone off the top of my head. I'm so sorry.
That's completely fine. Can you think of a hot celebrity?
My brain is just thinking about kind people that I don't actually have any attraction towards in the 70s for some reason. And none of the hot people are coming into my...
That's actually so funny. You're like, I can only think of kind, ugly people. It's crazy.
Oh my God. I find I think I have a bit of a kindness kink. I think I find it very sexy when people are kind. Like literally they're like, I had someone that used to contact me going, I've just taken my mum out to the theater and I've also planned a surprise birthday for my sister. And I was like, get here now and remove all your clothes.
That's actually extremely hot. It's also, it's giving like, I can get a task done. Which is another thing I'm very attracted to. You know, it's a good combination. Like
I am not good at. So like, yeah, it's always, it's that kind of thing. But honestly, I can't think of anyone off the top of my head. Isn't that terrible?
No, who needs them? I know that already you're going to be like, can't pick the best. What is a great restaurant that you've eaten so far at this year?
How much restauranting have I even been doing this year is the real question. A restaurant that I can pretty much always recommend is Silo in East London. It's just so interesting. It's such an interesting place. They do like, it's like a zero waste concept restaurant ultimately. And it can be quite hipster. I think I took someone there and they were like, is this a single mushroom on a plate with some sauce? And I was like, it kind of is, yes.
But I mean, it is, of course, but it's going to be very tasty.
Delicious. It's always delicious. It's always delicious. And they're really innovative and like would recommend.
What is your favorite city in the UK?
London. It just is London. Like, it just is. Like, I've been to lots of other places and they've all got their charm. But I like how big London is. I like how there's always something to find to do. I like that it's super diverse. Like, I think it's easier to be queer here than many other cities in the UK. Like, I just love it. But second, Brighton.
Okay, the last one you can take a little more time with if you want, but we always like to ask, who is your hospitality hero? It can be someone you work with and know, or it can be somebody you've never met before, but somebody you look at in the industry where you're like, fuck yeah.
There's a few people. There's a few people. Lorraine Copes, who started Be Inclusive Hospitality. They are definitely one of them. I think they're an absolute powerhouse. They have made such waves in the industry and it's just really admirable. Definitely Toby Anna that runs Kelly's Cause, actually. Like, starting something like this off the back of such tragedy and that's so personal and keeping it going all these years with all the challenges that must have posed is just, I think it's really amazing. My friend Keisha, the one that used to run Caribe, she's just so nice. She's just exactly one of the kindest people, but also just, you know, she really doesn't hold back from the murky truth around where recipes come from the Caribbean and stuff like that, and or some of the murky truth and some of the celebrated stuff as well, and is quite outspoken about racism within the industry. So I guess the people that are doing a lot of the activism are the people that stand out for me as my kind of heroes. Like with food, like there's all kinds of delicious food and I just can't pick any one that's like, you know, really amazing. There's so many things that I've eaten that have been great and so many chefs that I think their stuff is really amazing. Oh, and I guess also Easter Belfridge, my old mentor, because they're very boldly going forward with their own style and boldly like crossing cultures and breaking lots of rules with the way that they do things. And, you know, it's quite fun and anarchistic, but with a very cute little smiley face on her the whole time.
This has been such a joy to talk to you.
It's been fun.
We are always just looking at everything that you're doing and being so delighted. And also just the support you give us as an organization means a lot. So thank you for taking the time. This has been fab.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm super grateful to be here. And like, yeah, I definitely give all the support to you guys because it is, you know, it's very meaningful what you're doing. And I think it's important. I think I previously said before that it saves lives because it literally does. This kind of training, knowing more about mental health and knowing how to support people better in their mental health, literally saves lives. So I'm very, very happy to be here. You keep up the good work. I'll keep up the good work. All that kind of stuff.
Beyond the Pass is produced by Kelly's Cause. For more information about Kelly's Cause, please head to kellyscause.com or find us on Instagram at kellyscause.